From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Admit it. For some of you, a novel written by a Mormon mother of five, whose main character is a Mormon mother of five, is going to put you off at first. Mehdi Ivy Harrison worried about that when she first pitched the book to a publisher. She was confident about the story. It's a murder mystery with twists and turns, but it's based in Draper, Utah, and not just that, but in a Mormon ward neighborhood. The main character is the wife of a bishop. Well, it turns out the publisher was interested in that part. In fact, her editor said she wanted even more details about Mormon culture. It's like Mormons are a different country, the woman told her. They speak a different language, and you're the interpreter. Well, now the book's been published. It's getting a lot of national attention. And today in the program, Harrison will join us to talk about it. It's called The Bishop's Wife, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, writer Mehdi Ivy Harrison is with us. We're talking about her new novel, which is getting a lot of attention around the country. Harrison's written a lot of books, actually. She's written young adult fantasy romances. She has a memoir. This latest, though, is her first adult novel. It's a murder mystery, and it's set in Draper, Utah. The person doing the sleuthing is the bishop's wife. That's the name of the book, The Bishop's Wife, which Harrison has built out of very real settings and very real elements of Mormon culture. Harrison herself is LDS, which is just one of the parallels between her character and her own life. She's joining us to talk about that connection, about her writing, about the mystery, of course, although we're not going to give anything away, I promise. You can join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Mehdi Ivy Harrison is a novelist based here in Utah, lives in Layton, as a matter of fact. And she has events this month in Utah. We'll get to the details about that as we go along. I should also mention she's a guest blogger for Flunking Sainthood at Religion News Service. And Mehdi Ivy Harrison, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Okay, so I wanted to start with a book that you had written. I guess it's been several years ago now, The Monster in Me.
Yes, that was my first young adult novel that was published and my only contemporary. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've talked about the fact that this in that book, it was your first attempt at trying to get at the Mormon world in which you lived, if I get that right. But you also have talked about how you felt a little constrained about how you talk about Mormon. What do you mean? What was the deal?
There were two reasons that I felt constrained. One is that because that was my first novel, I honestly wasn't good enough as a writer to be able to write about complicated issues about religion in a way that I think would interest a wide national audience. And I think the second reason, to be honest, is that that was before the Mormon moment. It was before national readers were really interested in Mormonism. And so I think that I got some subtle hints from my publisher and from my agent that perhaps, you know, dial back a little bit on the Mormonism. There are some, you know, slight hints that this is a Mormon family. The girl who's the main character of the book is a girl who's in foster care, and she stays with a Mormon family, and they go to church and they say prayers, but I don't ever quote the prayers. I don't have them talk about doctrine, and that's about as far as I go.
But what did you want to say about Mormonism, did you think? Or what did you want to write about Mormonism at that time? Did you have something?
I didn't want to write about Mormonism. I wanted to have a chance to set a book in Utah because I felt like it was a unique location and it would make the book stand out a little bit more. And then secondarily, I was interested in the legal system in Utah for foster care kids, and specifically the emphasis in Utah on keeping the family together, which I think still exists to this day, rather than looking at what's in the best interest of the child. So, I mean, that's in the background of the whole story. I don't know if young adult readers necessarily get it. Probably adult readers who read the book can see that Natalie's being sent back to her mother at the end of the book because the government wants the family to be intact.
Yeah. So, but then the Mormon moment comes and
yes.
things change. And so now in your you've talked about the conversation. I heard you in an interview talking about the fact that when you were pitching the book, you thought, okay, let's see how far I can go with this. And I guess it was your editor or maybe the publisher said, no, we want more stuff about Mormonism, not less.
Yeah, we joke around, Juliet and I, sometimes that basically her editorial letters are more Mormon stuff on every single page. She's fascinated by Mormons. But, I mean, it's not because it's a fascination with the weird. She's honestly interested in why Mormons do what we do and why what we believe, actually. And I feel like there aren't a lot of books that do a good job of explaining Mormonism in a way that is neutral.
Yeah.
So neither trying to convert people nor, you know, trying to expose the underseamy side of Mormonism.
So what changed between that time and now? Why is there more of an appetite, do you think, for stories about Mormonism?
Well, I mean, I think Mitt Romney is a big part of that.
Yeah.
The Book of Mormon musical is probably part of it. I think there are just a few things that have happened that have made the national attention sort of think of Mormons less as a cult and more as, you know, a genuine religion that's different
yeah.
and is truly American. I have heard a lot of people say to me that they are interested in Mormonism because it's the only religion, only major religion that, you know, was born out of America and American ideals, American farm boy, and people are interested in that.
Janet Maslin reviewed the book for the New York Times. She really liked it a lot. And she liked, I think, the context from which you had written, you know, in the conceit of Mormonism in this, you know, ward neighborhood in Draper, Utah. And this was something I was asking you off the air here a moment. Do you ever wonder if the book or worry about whether the book is being judged based on just that kind of novel idea of it being about Mormon characters? And do you just wish they'd sort of set that aside and consider it based on its merits, that it's a good mystery and well-written, all of those things?
I don't spend a lot of time worrying about that. I do think that the book is stands on its own as a mystery,
yeah.
but mystery readers like novelty, and they're interested in the book because it's a mystery set specifically in Mormon culture. And the mystery that I chose to write about doesn't make as much sense if you take it outside of the Mormon culture. I mean, I chose specifically a book about a mystery that's about gender roles because I think that's an interesting thing to talk about in the context of Mormon culture and Mormon scripture.
Yeah.
And without that, I'm not sure that it would be a very interesting mystery.
Do you worry? I'm wondering about it's more complicated than this to say there are readers out there who are mainstream Mormons and readers out there who don't care much about Mormonism or aren't Mormon. But do you worry that on some level, maybe just here in Utah in particular, some readers who may feel annoyed about Mormonism, you know, conservatism or their political power, you know, being kind of ambivalent about Mormonism or being reminded about Mormonism, do you worry about that? Do you think those people will pick this book up? And then on the counter, mainstream Mormons, will they be interested in a book like this?
You know, I just had a book club with my own ward, and I acknowledged them in the back of the book. I've been with this group of women for a long time. Some of them have actually read the book in its very early stages, but I was very, very nervous about going to this group. One of the women in the group is my actual bishop's wife. One of the other women was my bishop's wife when I went through a lot of the things that led me to write this book. And I was just so relieved that their response was, "We can't understand why anyone thinks that this book is controversial in terms of your depiction of Mormonism." They felt like I'm spot on about the bishop's wife, about the ward. Sure, there are some bad guys in the book. Not everybody has a bad guy in their ward as bad as the bad guys in this book, but some people do. Clearly, I've drawn this from real life. There are people who are murderers within our Mormon community. As for people who are not interested in Mormonism or who are tired of it, I've actually been surprised. A lot of people have picked up this book who are not Mormons and have felt like it's a really fresh take on the very people that they're living, who are living around them. And they feel like, wow, I didn't know that this is why they believed what they believe. Now I am more interested in, you know, the lives, the inner lives of the people that I thought were uninteresting before.
So did you approach Deseret Book about trying to sell this book in, you know, Mormon-owned
books? I never did.
No.
In the early days, in 2012, I wrote the first draft in January 2012, and I sent it out to four friends. And one of the things that I asked them was, do you think that I should send this to a national publisher, or do you think that I should send this to Deseret Book? And all of the friends were like, no, don't send this to Deseret Book. There's no way that you could rewrite this, that it would be acceptable to Deseret Book, which is probably, I don't know, to be fair, I've never been able to sell a book to Deseret Book. I have sent them many, many different manuscripts. And somehow I don't have a voice that fits with what they think is publishable to the Mormon community.
Why?
I can only make guesses,
yeah,
but
of course.
I think that my best guess is that I'm too
honest,
thoughtful, too thought-provoking, maybe. I think that Deseret Book likes to have a picture of Mormonism that is mostly not quite perfect, but has very small flaws. And that is not the picture of Mormonism that I see, and it's not the one I'm interested in writing about. And I think that readers who, you know, like to go to Deseret Book to find those books, they're used to getting those books there. And it perhaps would not have been a good marriage in any case that those readers would have been unhappy with this book. So
yeah. I wondered the plot that you came up with. So loosely based, at least the initial idea is,
yes,
this Susan Powell case. She disappears. I guess that was the jumping off point. I mean, it goes off into another direction at some point, and I won't, again, give anything away, but that was the thing that got you started, I guess?
Yeah. As I watched the Powell case unfold and saw the terrible ending, I could not help but wonder about the ways in which Mormonism influenced the outcome of the case. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that women don't feel oppressed in marriages outside of Mormonism, but I think that the way that women think about whether or not they should stay in an abusive marriage is influenced by Mormonism. And I try to lay that out. And I also think that the community around these women, whether or not they feel able to reach out and ask for help, and whether or not people are looking for those signs, is a problem that Mormonism has, I think, because we expect so much to see perfect people or nearly perfect people that we don't notice the signs of problems. And so I wanted to write about that. It's the first scene is very much sort of what happened with Josh Powell, and then after that I go off completely in my own direction. I don't want to pretend that I know, you know, particular details about the Powell case that I don't know, but I wanted to talk about how marriage and the idea of Mormon eternal marriage can make a mess of things.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You told Ellen Fagweest of the Tribune that when you started writing it, you didn't really know who the murderers would be or the bad guys necessarily would be. Is that right?
That is true. I'm not sure if that's something that I should brag about or not. I tend to write. I have always written very much organically, and I actually thought that I could never be a mystery writer because I had heard that mystery writers have to be very meticulous about red herrings and knowing who the murderer is in advance.
Because you have to map it all out.
Yeah. And so I just sat down. I was just playing with this idea, and I honestly was not sure that this book would ever sell. So I was just writing along, and originally I thought that the husband would be the murderer in the book. But obviously that would be not a very interesting book if the suspicion from the very beginning is a particular person and that person turns out to be the murderer. Everybody would throw the book across the room. So there are many twists and turns and different suspects in the book. I have now written several of these. I'm working on book three right now. And every time I wake up and sit down to write for the day, and I have this sick feeling like I hope that I eventually figure out who the murderer of this book is going to be, because I don't usually figure it out until I'm about three-fourths of the way through.
Wow. How do you describe, mystery is, I suppose, the genre. That's where it will fit in a bookstore, I guess. But it almost seems to be as much about this character, Linda, whom we'll get to shortly here, but it's about Linda and her connection to the other women in her life, her evolving sense of God, kind of the nature of God, her grief. She's lost a daughter, a stillborn child, and so it's a lot about that too. And I'm not sure that they are mutually exclusive in any way, but that is interesting. It's as much about her personal part as it is about really the twists and turns of a crime.
I have been a mystery reader for a long time. I have some particular favorites. One of them is Sue Grafton and her Kinsey Millhone books. And I feel like the great thing about those books is that they are just as much about Kinsey Millhone and about her journey, figuring out who she is. At the beginning in the series, you don't know how rich Kinsey's past is. You don't understand that she's lost her parents and that she was raised by this aunt. And then you don't realize that she has relatives that she will meet in later books. So I feel like in that sense, I'm very much following a tradition of mystery. And of course, that's only one example. I could list, you know, five or six other series that I follow very carefully. But I also feel like I'm very specifically twisting certain expectations of the genre. And I think the best writers do this. They know what the formula is, and then they deliberately refuse to follow the formula. And one of the things I'm doing in this book is I very much want this to be a woman's detective novel. And as much as I love Kinsey Millhone, I feel like Sue Grafton started writing her in the 80s. Very much a time of trying to see if you could write a female character exactly like a male character. And I absolutely respect that goal. But my goal is to write a mystery that is very much about a traditional female character. So I wanted to explore how much of a mystery I could write about somebody who wasn't a detective in any way, shape, or form, and who was a very traditional woman who thought of herself as a mother and wife first and not as a detective first.
Mehdi Ivy Harrison is with us. Her new novel is called The Bishop's Wife. Tomorrow night at 6:30, she's going to be giving a reading at the Pleasant Valley branch of the Weber County Library. Harrison is chair of writing for charity, by the way. It's a conference for children's book writers that raises funds to get books into the hands of kids. They're going to be meeting a little bit later this month on March 21st. And then there's a reading at the Springville City Library. She's got a lot of stuff going on. You can go to her website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Mehdi Ivy Harrison. We're talking about her new book. It's a mystery. It's getting a lot of attention nationally. It's called The Bishop's Wife. She's going to be reading from it in a number of different places. We can give you the details a little bit later. You can go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. Okay, so I'm looking at Linda Walheim, this character mm-hmm. that you created. And I'm trying to figure about how much of that is you, Mehdi Ivy Harrison, and how much of that is Linda Walheim, how much of that is a creation. So I started making a list of things that I think might connect to you. Linda's a liberal politically. I'm going to guess you are somewhat that. You can say or not. She's a woman who has some critical, maybe too strong of a word, but she has some very particular views, open views in some ways on religion, but she tends to keep her opinions to herself. This is Linda. I'm wondering if that's you. Janet Maslin says in the Times Review that Linda is no mover or shaker, but she has her opinions. She's a strong woman. She likes mystery. So do you. She had a daughter who was stillborn very late in the pregnancy. Obviously, that we'll get to that, but that's another connection there. She was an atheist for a time. So are you. She has at least one child who's turned away from the LDS church. So do you. She's an unabashed Mormon feminist, has a connection to a mother in heaven, feels somewhat frustrated by the way women may be treated at times in the Mormon church. I'm going to guess so do you on some level.
There's some similarities there.
So how much of that is Linda? How much of that is you? Did you think about this as very personal, Linda?
I deliberately made Linda not like me in some very specific ways. Yes, Linda has a lot of thoughts about Mormonism that are my thoughts. But I'll enumerate some of the differences between me and Linda that I think make her a very distinct character, separate from me. Linda is an older woman in her 50s. She doesn't have children left at home. I still have three teenagers at home. Linda is physically, she's overweight, and that comes out in the book at several points when she tries to run.
You're a triathlete.
I am a nationally ranked triathlete.
Yeah.
And exercise a lot every day. And I have a PhD, which Linda has not ever finished her degree. And I have a career outside of raising my kids. So those are some ways in which I am not at all Linda. And I made Linda, in my mind, to be what I thought to be a more ordinary Mormon woman, in part because I feel like if I wrote about a character like myself, I wondered how relatable I would be, which maybe sounds strange, but I've spent some of my life thinking that other Mormon women are intimidated by me, and I struggle with friendship sometimes within the Mormon church. And I think that is one of the reasons that I am so ambitious and driven, and that's not something that people around me understand or...
Let me put that in context for a minute first. Okay, you grew up in New Jersey. Your father, a scholar and professor, made his way to Utah to teach at BYU as a professor. You made it through Brigham Young University in like 2 years or some crazy thing, went then to Princeton to get a PhD in Germanic literature, lived for a time in Germany.
Yes.
So you're an achiever. Did you feel...
That might be an understatement,
that
yes.
That might be an understatement.
I'm a compulsive achiever.
And you're also... How many kids in your family? You're
11.
11
I'm the ninth
kids.
Of 11.
Are they all driven in that way? All honest?
Many of my siblings are very driven. You would see many similarities between me and them. And also very well educated as a group, bluntly honest, sometimes to the detriment of careers. But I'm the only one who has a PhD, and I remember distinctly my father calling me on the phone when I told him that I had successfully defended my dissertation at last. I talked to him on numerous occasions about problems I was having with professors. My father had a much more difficult time finishing his PhD than I did. He had six children, I think, before he actually defended his dissertation, so no. I had one. Anyway, he called me on the phone and he said, "Congratulations, Dr. Ivy." And I realized I had been married for 5 years at that point, and realized that my father had been planning this speech out for most of his life, hoping that one of his children would eventually be Dr. Ivy. And I said to him, "Dad, I'm Dr. Harrison." And I think he was a little disappointed that I was no longer Dr. Ivy. So, there were very, very high expectations in my family. Sometimes I tell people in high school, I was on the swim team for the 3 years I was in the high school, and my parents never attended a single swim meet that I was at. Of course, I was not a very good swimmer, but they had came to every single academic assembly that I won an award at, and it was very clear in our family what my parents cared about. And my kids now say to me that if they come to us and ask us to buy them something, we tend to say, no, we're trying to be frugal and we have five kids and I don't earn a lot of money as a writer. So, but if they say, but it's for school, then we immediately go out and buy whatever they've asked for, because we also value academics and an achievement very highly at our house. So those are things that Linda does not have and are really not part of her life.
But it seems to me, maybe you don't agree, the core stuff is you. Religious beliefs, sense of feminism, broad sense of the nature of God. I mean, really basic stuff. That sounds like you. Am I wrong?
That is how I would like to be. I spent a long time as an atheist and am really trying to come back to a belief in God. And part of that project was writing about Linda, who is somebody who, even though she has spent some time as an atheist and I think understands what atheism is, she is very much not an atheist. Right. Her default is to believe in God.
Right.
And I am not sure that that is true of me. It's something I would really have tried to work on lately, when I think of...
what do you mean? Your default is to...
Is to not believe not in God. For instance, I went to a family funeral recently, just last week. My young nephew died unexpectedly and is still an unexplained death. And at the funeral, many people mentioned that he was in the room with us watching family members there, and he was enjoying the funeral. And my default, honestly, is not to believe in an afterlife. And it's not something I like about myself, but that is not Linda's default.
No.
So, I mean, she so strongly believes in God, and she yells at God and shouts at God sometimes. Again, not my default, because I still struggle with believing in any God at all.
There's this particular scene in the book where Linda has come to this kind of sense about the nature of God. She's been through this atheism period. And she's talking to another character, a woman named Gwen. And Gwen and her husband are going through this kind of rough patch. And Gwen starts to mention this saying, God never gives us more than we can handle. Mm. And Linda kind of cuts her off and says, she says, I hate that saying. Because it seems like God is playing some game with people. But then she also says, but I do believe that God weeps with us. She says her favorite scripture, there's this scripture in the Bible, in the book of John, I think it is, that says Jesus wept. Linda says, that's my favorite scripture. So there's like two things going on. On one hand, she is not sure where God is in the universe, whether God, in fact, does play games with humanity. But she knows enough to think that God is love, right? And God is empathy. Does that make sense?
Linda is, in part, I dedicate the book to my friend Sue Gong, who is the best parts of Linda, those really believing parts. And some of those quotes that you're suggesting about Linda and her firm belief in God and what he is like come directly from my friend Sue Gong, who talked to me many times about whether or not I was an atheist. She's of the firm belief that I never was an atheist and that I was just angry at God. I don't know whether that's true or not.
Is Sue Mormon?
Sue is Mormon. Okay, she's a liberal Mormon who lives outside of Utah. She's in New Hampshire. So we talk mostly on the phone. But she believes in God in a way that I wish that I could. I mean, she talks about things like miracles that happen in her life all the time. Every moment of every day, she thinks about God. And so I based Linda in part on her character. And in part on, you may be surprised to know, on Christine Card, Orson Scott Card's wife. I'm friends with Orson Scott Card, and we actually did a signing together for the bishop's wife. Wow. And I remember having a conversation with him. He drove me back to the airport afterwards, and we had this long conversation. He has lost two children, one right after birth and one who had cerebral palsy, I think, and had died in his late teens. And he also said to me, he hates so much this idea that God plans every part of our lives and watches to see what we will do, as though it is some kind of test. He feels like to believe in a God like that, you just can't live in the world, because you have to believe that things happen accidentally. And I think that is something I put into Linda, and that is something I believe firmly. If you're going to believe in God, you cannot believe that he plans everything as some sort of test.
So Linda's kind of figuring this out, and on some level, you kind of wish you were there.
Yeah, I think she's further along than I am.
That's interesting. See, because I was always thinking this was you.
Yeah, I wish.
There is a section I want to have you read. This is on page 105. This is a moment, I mean, you, and we'll talk a little bit more, you also lost a daughter. This was would have been your sixth child.
Yes. Now, that is very deliberately something I put of myself in Linda.
Yes. And one of the things that you've talked about, one of the things that used to bother you when the baby died was that you kept hearing all these kind of pat answers about, don't worry, you'll see her again in the,
yes,
and then in the next life, and trying to explain what had happened. Why did that bother you, by the way? I mean, they're trying to comfort you. You get that they have a good intention.
People have asked me a lot why I was not comfortable with the answers. And I don't know if I have a great answer for that. Possibly the real answer was I was going through a very deep depression, and therefore no answer would have satisfied me.
Yeah.
Another answer might be that I am the sort of person who once an idea gets stuck in her head, has to toy with it over and over again until she's satisfied. And none of those were satisfying to me on an intellectual level, and right. therefore I could not let them go.
There's a section here when Linda is talking about this. It's not a very long section. I'm going to have you read this because I think it's really interesting. When she refers to having been an atheist for a few years for the same circumstance. She lost her faith at this time when she lost her child.
No.
No.
She was an atheist
before. Oh, before that. That's right. Yes. That's where it doesn't parallel with your life. That's right. So she had, before all of that, that's right. She had toyed with the idea of she was an atheist for a while.
And I explain in book two, this is one of the threads that is not completely answered in book one. I explain exactly why she became an atheist.
Got it. Okay. Good. All right. Read the section, if you would. Kurt that you're referring to here, of course, is the bishop of the bishop's way.
Yes. I had been an atheist for several years before Kurt and I married, and this was why. Other Mormons feel a constant sense of direction, even in the minutiae of their lives, but I never had. Often I struggled to feel any clear spiritual feeling at all. But I came back to Mormonism and to God because even if what I felt was very little, it was better to search for more than give up on anything beyond the mundane. At least it was for me. Even when my daughter had died and I had been angry at God, I had still wanted him to exist. Because if he didn't, then none of my pain mattered at all. None of it made any sense. It was just random chance that she had died, just animal reaction that I mourned her loss. I wanted my life and hers to mean more than that.
Does that mirror what sort of where, because you went through a process yourself. I mean, your crisis of faith came after your daughter died, unlike Linda's, obviously.
Yes.
And you've talked about how that you had lost this sense of kind of what the purpose of God was.
Yes.
And that you had to, this is how you've put it, that you had to figure out how to believe in God again.
I did.
Take me through that.
I felt like people around me kept saying things like, this happened to you for a reason, and you need to find out the reason why. I'd heard people say that I needed to be more humble and stop complaining that my life was so terrible because there were many other things in my life that I needed to be grateful for. I even had one woman tell me that, and again, I'm sure she meant the best. She's still a friend of mine, but she told me just days after I lost my child that she had a friend whose child had died with shaken baby syndrome. And she said that after this friend of hers had lost her child, that her whole family had turned around and had become more spiritual. And now they all knew they were going to go to the celestial kingdom where her daughter would be waiting for them. And I kept thinking, But wait, I didn't do anything wrong. And there's a kind of pride in that, I suppose, that this feeling that I couldn't see what it was that I was supposed to repent from or what lesson I was supposed to learn. And I still don't. I still honestly cannot see what lesson God would have wanted to teach me or my husband or anybody by killing a child. It just seems like the most monstrous thing. And I am a mother in my bones. I love my children so deeply. I would have had more children if I could have had more children. I find enormous satisfaction in watching my children grow up. I talk to other mothers about parenting teenagers in particular because I feel like I am very good at loving and nurturing kids who want to do something opposite from what you intend for them to do. But this was a loss that I could not get past. And after a couple of years of coming home from church every Sunday, suicidal and having fantasies of cutting myself, the only thing I could think of to do to stay alive was to stop believing that God wanted this for me. And I spent, another three or four years within the Mormon church watching Mormons do things and coming up with explanations for why they did them that had nothing to do with God or anything supernatural. And I actually came to love Mormonism in a strange way by watching people do things that didn't make any sense to me on a spiritual level. But I watched people do things for other people and show kindness. And yes, there's a lot of stupid stuff that goes on sometimes. But there's so much goodness in the church that I ended up falling in love with Mormonism all over again and coming back to it, I think. And deciding that I wanted to believe in God again. I wanted to believe in something outside of myself. And again, I'm not sure that I'm there yet. Linda is further along than I am.
What? So what you were seeing was just basic human decency expressed by people, that it didn't have to be necessarily connected to some fear of damnation or motivated by making it into some grand kingdom in heaven, but it was just basic human nature that people were good? Is that, was that
I don't know
it?
If it's basic human nature, but for instance, the visiting teaching program was something that actually, before I lost my daughter, I was not a fan of and did not perform on a regular basis unless I had a partner who insisted on it, in which case I was happy to go along. I find it difficult to call people on the phone, and so it was hard for me to set up appointments, and it felt awkward to give people spiritual lessons. But after I lost my daughter, I started to watch women connect with each other in a way that I felt was really important, that they are assigned to each other. You're assigned to visit a certain number of women and to have a partner who you connect with, and you go and visit people every month and you talk about their lives. And I just ended up feeling like this was a really important part of my life and my connection to other women in the community, that I didn't need to think about God and whether God wanted me to do this. It was just that I needed to have a sense of connection with other women, and that on a level of just being mothers instead of, I mean, I have a lot of friends outside of Mormonism who are writers, and I connect with them enormously on that level. But this was a level of being moms, and I just felt like I started to do visiting teaching so much more regularly after I stopped believing in God, because I needed it. And it's funny, I told a friend of mine this story, and she said, "Maddie, that's the best testimony of visiting teaching I've ever heard." And I thought, well, wait, that's not what I mean.
That connection to other women is actually, I think, an important theme in your book, The Bishop's Wife, and I want to talk about that when we get back from a break. Maddie Ivy Harrison is with us. Her novel is called The Bishop's Wife. There are a number of events. I could go through some of these. She's going to be at the Pleasant Valley branch of the Weber County Library. She's going to be doing speaking at Writing for Charity. It's a charity she's involved with. That's going to be in Provo in March, later in this month. And she's also going to be reading at the Springville City Library later this month, too. We'll give you the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Maddie Ivy Harrison. We're talking about the book. It's her new novel, her first adult novel, by the way, The Bishop's Wife. And we've been talking about a few events that she's going to be participating in. You can get the details on our website. I'll give you the details about that a little bit later on the program. So Janet Maslin, I mentioned, really liked your book in the New York Times. And this is what she wrote in her review. She said, "Linda's Mormon community is very much a man's world." Is she right?
I think that's a really interesting thing to say. I think that it can look that way to outside observers when you see in general conference a sea of male faces, or even if you attend a sacrament meeting and you see only men on the stand. I don't think it's true. I think there's a secret connection of a secret fabric of feminine power within the Mormon Church. And I think there always has been. There's very much a history of feminism in the Mormon Church, and I think it still exists, but it can be invisible. And part of the purpose of The Bishop's Wife is for me to expose that. If I'm exposing anything, it's I'm exposing the power that ordinary Mormon women have and that everyone overlooks.
The Bishop's Wife, she, on some level, I mean, she is this invisible character in many ways. She sort of keeps to the background to some degree. Linda, she's always making cinnamon rolls and brownies and bread. But there's a kind of power there. That's the thing you're exposing, I guess, right?
Yeah. One of the reasons I deliberately made Linda different from me is that I feel like people outside of Mormonism see a woman like me and they think, oh, well, you're the exception to the rule. Women like you within Mormonism have power. And they don't see that the ordinary Mormon women, and I say ordinary, I hate that word, but people who look ordinary within Mormonism, Those women are the movers and shakers, no matter whether you think they are or not. You don't have to be a part of Ordain Women as a movement to see that women have power already and to think that women need to be more open about exercising it, and that men need to get more used to women exercising power within Mormonism. And of course, it varies from ward to ward. There are wards that women are doing already very interesting, visible things, but there are also wards where they're not.
I want to ask about a few characters that Linda connects to. You mentioned earlier that relationship that you with between women that was so, I guess, so moving for you, so important for you in this experience. And Linda's that same way. She really connects to women in the ward. And how does she pronounce that last name?
Torstenson.
Torstenson. Linda sees in this Anna woman a woman that, on some level, she's a career woman.
Yes.
She really was composed. She was able to sort of have both things. She was able to have, on some level, she's a devout Mormon, but on the other hand, she also had a career and a life that was just beyond that. So Linda really admires her as a character. There's a woman named Gwen. This is a woman who needs her help. And there are a number of these characters in the book, women that she really connects to for different kinds of reasons. I want to have you read this section from the book, but give me the sense it's kind of a sense of urgency that she's starting to feel about engaging with women and helping women.
Yeah, I mean, Linda has spent her life raising five sons, and I think a lot of mothers would relate to this idea that she hasn't had much of a life outside of raising her sons. She's spent a lot of time with scouting activities and school activities and devoting herself to time with these boys. And now that they're leaving the house, she has this opportunity to connect with other women that she really hasn't had before. So it is an awakening for her, in a sense of she now sees women in a different way. And of course, the victim of the disappearance early on in the book, Carrie Helm, is another woman that Linda realizes she saw parts of, yeah, but not all of. So suddenly Linda is now seeing there are women all around her, and some of them are very strong characters. You mentioned Anna Torstenson. Gwen is a strong character, but she is a woman who can't have children, and therefore Linda has a chance to connect to somebody who's not a mother. That is not part of her personality. And then there's also Sherry Tate, who is the Release Society president. And on some level, Linda connects with her, and on another level, she doesn't. They're a bit butting heads because they're both really strong personalities in different ways. So, yeah, Linda is becoming aware of women's issues sort of as the book evolves, and becomes a kind of champion of women who are not seen, like she is not seen, and women who are maybe misinterpreting Mormonism or who are feeling oppressed by Mormonism.
Yeah. What's going on here in this section?
Okay, here's the section. It says...
Do you need to set it up for us?
Let's see. I'm just going to read it and I'll give you background after.
Okay.
There might be some explanation for all of this, said Kurt. He always wanted there to be an explanation. But sometimes the explanation was that men took advantage of the power they had over their wives, in society and in the church. Even the kindest men in the church had no idea of the many ways in which they made their wives and daughters into lesser persons than their sons and fellow male church members. I wouldn't be where I am today without my wife, they say in testimony meetings. But what they are also saying is that their wives have given up their personal ambitions in favor of the ambitions of their husbands. Mormon men protect their daughters, but they encourage and cheer on their sons. And I, who had never had a daughter and had so few female friends still in the church, had done little more than any of the men had to help the women around me. But that had to change. I had to change first and make the church and culture change around me. First came speaking the truth. So this comes after she has discovered some of what's going on in the life of Carrie Helm, who is the woman who's disappeared early in the book. But she is starting to realize that the problems she sees in Carrie's relationship with her husband are not unique to that relationship.
Yeah. It's hard. We can't say a whole lot because, I mean, we don't want to give anything away. It's really gripping in that way in terms of the mystery.
But Linda also, I have heard some criticisms from people saying that the book is anti-male. And I want to say that in this one section, Linda and in other sections of the book, especially early on, Linta is, she believes that these men have abused their wives and that, and she looks for abuse everywhere. She is not always right. And that is also one of the lessons that she learns. She learns that she needs to stand up for women more, but she also learns that she can't always assume the easiest narrative, which is, oh, men are bad and, you know, all these women are victims. That is not what ends up coming out of the book at the end.
Yeah. Linda has come to this conclusion that there can in people's lives be acts that are just random, that didn't have any plan to them. I mean, there can be violence, there can be horrible things, and yet there can still be a God, that there doesn't necessarily have to be a plan drawn out. As Linda puts it, this is my Mormonism. But you're not there yet.
I am not there yet. I would like that to be... I really spend a lot of time every day trying to get there. I read my scriptures on a daily basis. I spend a good length of time in meditation / prayer.
So you're really trying.
I really am. Somebody said online in a review that I was an atheist hiding out in the Mormon church as though I had purposely planned to become an atheist and then to, you know, spent time going to sacrament meetings and doing my visiting teaching on a regular basis so that I could find out secrets of Mount Mormonism so I could write about them in my book. That is not the real narrative here. That I am somebody who's struggling, and I wish that my default were to believe again as I believed before I went through this faith crisis.
Yeah.
I hope that I can believe again. But even if I don't, I think that I see some beauty in Mormonism within all of its flaws. And I hope that comes out with Linda, that she also sees people doing good things for other people despite the bad guys that are in the world. And they are Mormon, some of them.
But here's another connection between, maybe I'm making too much of this. Kenneth, Linda's son, is having his own faith crisis. Your second daughter left Mormonism when she was like 15 or 16 years old, no longer considers herself a member of the LDS Church. And you've written in blogs about this that it's not because she hates Mormonism. So in this way, she sounds like you, doesn't hate Mormonism, but she couldn't believe in God because when she prayed, you know, crickets, like nothing. She didn't really feel anything. And in that sense, it seems like she's kind of like you, and you ask this really important question in your blog post. Is there a way that Mormons could be more inclusive of members of our church, although your daughter's no longer a member, but think of yourself.
Yeah.
Can they be more inclusive of members of the church who don't feel God's presence? What do you think the answer is? When you look in your ward in Layton, Utah, and you're in Davis County, can they make room for you?
I think my ward has made room for me. I mean, I think my experience at my book club is part of that. I will say that I have been in the nursery for almost 4 years now and have therefore not attended a Relief Society meeting and have not attended a gospel doctrine class for a long time. I go occasionally if nobody's at the nursery, but I am not always sure if my comments are welcome because they come from a place of doubt sometimes,
yeah,
and from an experience of atheism. So I wish that teachers were able to negotiate that more. But on the other hand, we have a lay clergy and we don't spend a lot of time training people. So those people are learning on the job as much as I am learning on my job, or as much as I am learning to try to articulate my problems with Mormonism. So I try to be forgiving. I think it's a hard road. I feel like I am learning also to be more tolerant of other people's experiences as much as I'm hoping that they will be tolerant of mine. And I was going to say, I think that there are people, my daughter, I don't think went through a faith crisis. I think she just decided she wasn't a Mormon.
Yeah.
And I think people go through, I think that's a different experience.
Huh.
And learning how to deal with somebody who's going through a faith crisis is actually a different.
What's the difference? Because someone believes and then falls out of belief? She didn't really ever have a belief?
she didn't have a specific precipitating event that led to the faith crisis. And yeah. I think people who have a faith crisis always have an event. Like, this event made it so that I was asking questions that I could not find an answer to. And then they may fall out of belief or they may not fall out of belief. Right. But my daughter just listened for a while and she just didn't realize she did not believe that, you know, that she would have liked to have believed, I think, at some point. Now she's past that and is just – she's happy with where she is. But I think dealing with those two kinds of experiences is very different. Having somebody who just says, I have never had an experience in which I believed in God is different than somebody who said, I had an experience – I had experiences that I believed were from God, but now I am not so sure anymore.
So there's a second book. There's a third book.
We have 9 planned.
Wow. Okay. So, and then here's something that you said that I found intriguing. You say you have something very particular in mind for Linda, a very specific arc in mind. I'm obviously not going to tell you to give that away, but something in mind. And do you have a connection to her? I mean, do you really love her as a character, as a kind of a...
She has been the easiest character I have ever written. And I don't know if that's really because she is like me, or if it's just that I care so much about the things that she cares about. I care about the outcome of the larger character story that I am telling about her. I mean, obviously, writers love all of the books that they've written. They wouldn't bother to spend hours and years working on them if they didn't. But this is a special book to me. It feels like it is more about me and my concerns than other books have been. And in that sense, it feels scarier to write because even though I can sit down and it's easy to write, I also am aware that because it's gotten a lot more attention and because it's about my own world, the criticisms hurt a lot more than criticisms hurt about fantasy. I mean, I can talk about issues that interest me in Mormonism in a fantasy context without them feeling like they are specific to our culture and world. But in this book, no, I can't get away with that. This is all us now.
Mehdi Ivy Harrison, her new novel is called The Bishop's Wife. She's going to be participating in a number of readings and events in the month of March, this month. You can get all the details about them on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Mehdi Ivy Harrison, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.